Welcome to A Couple of Nobodies podcast. This is our first actual guest recording.
Yeah.
And I should have asked off air, but I'm going to call him Micah V because I have no idea how to pronounce his last name. Give us your last name, Micah.
Voritskul.
I was wrong.
You nailed it, man. You totally nailed it, Jeff.
I'm a linguistics expert, I think. I don't know.
I butchered that in the kitchen today.
I was trying.
I owe you an apology, actually.
Well, we're going with Micah V on this, so maybe that'll catch on. But Micah is the author of Human is New Vinyl, which I'm really stoked about that conversation. He's also the founder of Verified Human. He's an AI strategist, which we're going to jump into the AI conversation, helping individuals navigate the tension of humanity and artificial intelligence. But I wanted to start right here. I was kind of on your LinkedIn, and you posted about making a mixtape for your wife, which I'm a mixtape guy. I got to know what was on the mixtape.
Okay. I have the list right here for you. I didn't originally post it because I didn't think anybody would care, but everybody was like, oh my gosh, what was on the list? So you want me to blow through all these?
Give us like the top five.
It's not that long. I'll just give them all. So Tougher Than the Rest by Everything But the Girl.
Okay.
Wrap Your Arms Around Me by Bare Naked Ladies. Southern Rain, Cowboy Junkies. Friday, I'm in Love, The Cure. One and Mysterious Ways by U2. Fields of Gold by Sting. Rome by the B-52s. Fall at Your Feet by Crowded House. Sea of You by a guy named David Garza. Cigarette by the Smithereens. Orinoco Flow by Enya. When I Win the Lottery by Camper Van Beethoven. And then rounding it out with Euro Trash Girl by Cracker.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like you're not finding all of them on the same stage at like a festival. That's a plethora of artists right there.
Yeah, I mean, that's not to mention like how much I love like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles.
Yeah.
But I was trying to do something for Christy, you know, that would be like, that would say something without saying something, you know?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, like 16-year-old me was like all about that mixtape life, like the queuing up. And like, it was easy when you went from CD to cassette.
Yeah.
But cassette to cassette was like, man, that was the challenge. That's where the difficulty lied.
Now, I'm sorry, guys. We were Napster. Like, for me, it was like stealing music off of Napster to email it.
Yeah, well, Napster was actually for people who were legitimate music fans. Napster was both kind of a negative thing because it was like unscrupulous, but a positive thing because like I'm like, well, I'm rebuilding the music library that I've always owned. Like, so I've paid for songs by U2. Like, I've paid for those songs so many times in the past, right? But I no longer have the cassettes or the vinyl warped or whatever, but I should have the right to listen to the song that I purchased like six times, right? Even if I don't have the file on my computer. So for people who, you know, like me, I was like, I'm going to download everything that I've purchased in the past. I'm not going to like reach out beyond that. But Napster was like kind of cool. I was like, wow, I can rebuild this library that I've lost or got stolen or got ruined or whatever along the way. It was great.
I felt like a hacker. I felt like it was the first time I was like, oh my gosh, this is the dark web.
It was like Costco for me. Like I was like going down the aisles and just taste testing everything.
Yeah.
Like, do I really like this artist enough to invest in the CD?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah,
man. That's great.
So the book is titled Humans New Vinyl. So we gotta know, are you a vinyl guy?
I am. I'm not as big of a vinyl aficionado as some people. Like I don't have a huge vinyl collection, but I love vinyl, and you know, I have 10 or 12 albums. They're so expensive, but I rebuilt that vinyl collection after I started writing this book, and you know, bought a record player off of Amazon and what I could afford. My son's got a way nicer vinyl setup, but then I started realizing, man, these vinyl records are expensive. They're like 40 or 50 bucks a pop, so I'm like, have to choose the ones that I can afford really carefully. But I used to have crates. Me and my brothers had crates full of vinyl. I mean, we had hundreds of albums So it was awesome.
You couldn't, like, probably a decade ago, you couldn't give vinyl away. Like, it was so out of trend, and like the Goodwill would just have, like, again, crates, and you could, like, flip through them and pay a dime or a nickel for,
yeah,
hot, like, really nice vintage vinyl records. Now vintage is super expensive, and I think artists are figuring out they can make money back where there's not CDs anymore on selling vinyl.
So, yeah, my son is into it. Like McKay's, he's constantly wanting to go to the local shop to look through the vinyl stuff.
There are actually a couple of really good places in Cleveland to find vinyl, used vinyl, that's pretty cheap. Man, there was this one place, I can't remember the name of it. I'll have to see if I can find it and stick it in the notes or something later. But I found all kinds of really good stuff. I got like a Johnny Cash record for $1, and it was in perfect shape.
Nice.
And I found some Sonny and Cher. I mean, some really cool. That's how I can afford to buy it, is if I find like a little place that's got a vinyl and it's like $1 or $5 a pop, you know. So
yeah. Or some grandma's estate sale that like they don't know what they have. That's exactly where you gotta hit that up. So yeah.
Exactly.
So how did we get to the book then? Like you're kind of teasing out this artistry and this love for music. Where did you land on this idea that Human is the new vinyl? Like, where did that come from?
Well, we have to talk about the book. We really have to. It's really a book about how humans are constantly innovating, and we innovate in. We've innovated in writing, in visual arts, in music, in voice acting and voice in performance. We've innovated in technology and science. We, you know, human beings, if you're a believer, you believe that we're created by a God that's creative. And God is always creating. He's always building. He's always exploring. And, you know, and so humans made in God's image are creative by nature. And I've over the years collected a large group of creative friends, people who loved writing, they love writing in ways that most people don't. They love to draw, they love to sketch, they love to do stone sculpture. These are photographers and musicians that I have photographer friends that make a really good living doing photography. They're not just shooting weddings on weekends. I mean, they're taking pictures for big corporations.
Yeah.
You know, one of my colleagues is a guy named Jeremy Cowart. He's in Nashville. He's done portraits of the Obamas and Taylor Swift and Kim Kardashian and Tim Tebow and, you know, all these different people. So, I started, thinking about them when generative AI came out. I started going, oh man, this is going to hurt creatives. And we may be getting too far down the track.
No, but
I just wanted to reach back to that whole vinyl thing. And I started realizing that that human creativity is actually going to be a premium in the age of AI when everything becomes slop. I kind of knew early AI is going to take over the creative arts, and it's going to be generating a lot of junk. And pretty soon people are going to be wanting what's human again, and something that they can actually verify, like a person that I know made this. And so I started thinking about vinyl records, and I was like, man, vinyl was huge, right? In 1982, vinyl was king. The CD hadn't come out yet. I mean, Michael Jackson's Thriller sold 70 million copies in a year. I mean, come on. Think about that. That's like almost every family in America bought that album, you know? So you've got vinyl sales at a high, all time high. I mean, they sold 1 billion units globally in 1982, a billion.
Wow.
By 2002. So 20 years later, it was down to less than 500,000 albums sold in 2002. What would cause something to free fall from a billion to 500,000? That's a billion unit free fall, right? 900 million unit free fall. And it's because the CD came out, and because digital media came out, and MP3s came out, and streaming came out. And so people were like, and I want to take my music where I go. I want to be portable. I want, it's innovation. Hey, we can take, I can have 1,000 songs in my pocket, said Steve Jobs. Yeah. And all of a sudden, like the idea of having vinyl was a terrible idea. It's clunky. It's heavy. It's finicky. The record skips. If it scratches, it'll skip forever. If you step too hard in the living room, the record skips, you know, jumps. You can't take it to the beach. You can't take it in a car. Like, why would anybody ever want vinyl again? The interesting thing about that story is that vinyl has made a massive comeback, right? So now we're just talking about it. It's expensive. It's in vogue. People are doing it again. People are buying vinyl again. Artists now, all artists who are making good albums, they release their albums on CD and on vinyl, right? That's, in fact, vinyl is the main media, physical medium that they put it out on now. Mm-hmm. If it's not digital, it's vinyl. So what caused that to come back, right? That was the question. Like, why did vinyl make a comeback? Well, it's because it's nostalgic. It's because it's warm. It's because it's analog. It's because you have to put a record on the record player. You have to stay with it. You have to, it only holds 22 minutes of music per side. I mean, you listen to your five songs, you have to flip it over to get the other five. Yeah. You have to be there. And so it's something about that analog connection thing that came back, and something about the human thing. I just connected them together and said, hey, in the age of AI, I think human is going to be the new vinyl. I think it's going to make a comeback.
Yeah.
Was there
that was a super long answer. Sorry.
No, it's a great answer.
Was there like a light bulb moment when you saw and you were like, oh, this is changing everything? Or was this like you saw it over time, like an inner dialogue where you're like, oh, I see some stuff happening? Or was there this one moment where you saw something you're like, oh, man,
yeah, this is happening? That's a really great question, Brian. I would say that at first it didn't happen. Like, my realization didn't happen overnight. But in the summer of 2022, my son Ethan, who was a math and computer science major, he's graduating from Belmont this year. He's really, really forward in technology. Like, he knows about stuff before I have even read about it. So he brought me a Midjourney Stable Diffusion in summer of 2022. And if you don't know what those are models that generate images, AI models that generate images from text prompts. He's like, hey dad, this program can draw a picture of anything you want. Like, you just describe what you want. I was like, what are you even saying? I don't even understand what you're saying. What? He's like, you type into this prompt window or say into this prompt window with your voice, like what you want, and it'll draw it. I was like, what? What? And he was like, yeah, just if you say, I want you to draw me a picture of a dog riding a bicycle while eating banana, it'll do it. And you can say, do it in the style of Degas or Picasso, and it'll do that. I was like, okay. And at the time I was like changing this vent fan in our guest bathroom. I was on a ladder. I was like, tell it to draw a picture of a half Asian guy, like changing a vent fan in his bathroom, slightly angry. He did. He described that. And he showed me 10 images that were like photorealistic pictures of me doing exactly what I was doing in that moment that didn't exist in the universe like 30 seconds earlier. Yeah. And I looked at it and I was just like, holy moly, that's insane, man. Right after I said that, my thought was, this is going to crush visual artists. I don't know why my mind went there, but I was like, wow, this is going to crush visual artists. I just have a feeling. Then about 3 months later, he came and he said, hey dad, there's a new thing. It's called ChatGPT. And this is moreover than just images. This creates writing, but not just any writing. It creates writing at like a PhD level, and you can just ask it anything in the universe and it will answer at a PhD level, and it'll write it all out for you, and it'll explore things, and it'll have a conversation with you. And he's like, it's basically read everything that there is to read in the universe that's in print, and it's thought about all of it, and then it will like tell you what you need to know about anything. So we played with it, and we were writing poems with it, and we were writing limericks, and I had it write me some essays, and I had it take a Robert Frost poem and do a, like, you know, 5-page paper on it. And I thought, this is unbelievable, man. And my instant thought was, wow, this is going to crush writers, and it's going to be really bad for education, because we're going to have generations of students that graduate now who don't know how to think and don't know how to write for themselves. So yeah, I think that's when ChatGPT came out, that's when the light bulb hit. And I thought, this whole thing called generative AI, the idea that you've got this AI brain that parses tons of information and can create anything, is going to challenge all the creative arts. And I predicted that it was going to be able to make music better than humans. And I predicted that it was going to be able to make videos that were lifelike. And I predicted that the uncanny valley was going to go away and you wouldn't be able to tell anymore. So that's really when I realized, wow, this is a big deal for humankind, not just a fun little toy like Midjourney was. When ChatGPT came out, that's when it just hit me. I was like, this is a big deal.
Yeah. I feel like I live in the tension of like loving it as a tool and hating it at the same time. I mean, just honestly, because I got some vinyl records and I love physical media. I still love a book to hold in my hand. Yeah. But admittedly, I think our logo is ChatGPT made, you know, because I'm not a drawer. I don't draw. Brian doesn't draw. We have other creative skills. And it was just easy to tell it what to do and what we needed. So it's this real tension point of like, it's such a great tool, but we're trading something for it. Is there a point where we will trade one way or another, where we'll go again? Because I think digital media, our physical media is coming back. I think vinyl records, I read in 2025, actually surpassed $1 billion in sales for the first time since 1983. So it feels like we're at a tension point of like, we want to hold things in our hands, but we also want it done in 0.35 seconds.
Yeah. That is the conflict of the human natures. Like, we want it to be better, cheaper, faster. That is the mantra of all business in human. And when I say cheaper, I don't mean cheaper feeling. I mean less expensive to produce, right? So better, cheaper, faster has always been the human way. How can we do it better? How can we do it less expensively? And how can we do it faster? And all those things are in tension together, better and cheaper and faster. So AI solves a huge part of that problem, because it can do it better a lot of times, and it can do it cheaper for sure, and it can do it faster, 100% sure. Mm-hmm. So why is it not a good thing? That's a really hard question to answer. And I think for some things, AI is great. Like, I use AI every single day. I'm the founder of a movement that could be seen as anti-AI, but it's not at all. We're all humanists, in the sense that we want human. If it comes down to a machine and a human, I'll take the human every time. The human needs to win. If it comes down to a contest, if it's a contest between humans and machines, I always want the human to come out on top, right? So I think this is best expressed in, I went to Dr. Khan's, for those listening that don't know who Dr. Khan is, he was a former president of Lee University for something like 40 years. Anyway, I run a lot of harebrained ideas by him, but I went to Dr. Khan's office to tell him about Verified Human when I was founding it. And he asked me that question. He was like, Micah, why should anybody care if AI makes a picture or a logo, if you just need it to make something for you and it does a good job? I mean, you know, if you need a flyer for your pizza party at church, why don't you just have it generate your pizza party flyer and then get it out the door? You know, what's the big deal? And I said, you know, you're absolutely right. That's what AI is great for, right? That's what we use it for making a logo that if we can't afford to hire an artist to create it for us, right? I said, yeah. And in the case of a pizza party, yeah, sure. That's use AI. That's great. It's a, it's a picture of people eating pizza. It's disposable. It's not the Mona Lisa. I said, but look at this picture on your wall. Like, this is a picture of ships loading salt in Boston Harbor in 1877. This picture was painted by John Stobart. That's what the little plaque says. This picture at the bottom of it has his signature on it, and it says number 17 of 700. So it's a limited edition. You matted it and put it on your wall. I don't know what you paid for it, but just to mat it and put it on your wall, you probably paid like $500 or $600. Like, what? Why did you do that? You know? And he's like, well, I love that. I love this. I love Boston. I love Stobart's work. And I said, well, what if I told you that we could take that picture out of there and I could make you a picture instead that's exactly like this, with you and Mrs. Khan sitting on the back of that skiff? Would you frame that and hang it in your office? Because I can do that for you. And he was like, no. I was like, yeah, because it would be a cheap trick, right?
Yeah.
It's the reason he loved that picture is because he shared a human connection with the artist who has this generous vision of Boston in the 1800s. And they share this love and this moment together. He loves this guy's work. And the fact that John Stobart painted that picture by hand is what Dr. Khan loves about it, right? It's a cheap AI version of that picture would not be frameable. Well, why is that? And I said, so that's what Verified Human is about. You know, and he's like, oh, okay, I'm starting to understand.
Have you found it is hard for people to understand, like, across the board?
Yeah, I think it is. It's kind of a complicated idea, and I've realized that there's no real good elevator pitch for what Verified Human is, and there's no real good elevator pitch for the book either. Human is the New Vinyl. People are like, oh, that's a cool name. What does that even mean? You know, well, it's like, well, in the age of AI, you know, we're thinking that human creativity is going to make a comeback over and against AI slop. That's what it means. And we think that we should value things that humans make over things that machines make. That's not to say what comes out of AI is useless. That's not to say that AI isn't going to affect our lives in many awesome ways. Even generative AI. I'm not even talking about medical AI or car safety AI or telephone AI. I'm talking just about generative AI for, you know, creating media content, consumable content. It's great.
So are we gonna, do you think what Human is in the Vinyl is this anticipatory, it sounds like you're anticipatory of this return of the love of human creativity. Where is the tipping point, or where is the fatigue point with digitally produced things where we get to where we desire human creativity again?
Man, that's a fantastic question, Jeff. I don't know. I think it's going to be different for almost every individual. Certainly large pockets of like population. Like, I don't know. I think with kids, like, I think they're going to be okay with AI. Like, but you know, guys that are my age, that are our age, I got a few years on you guys, but, you know, we have a harder time wanting to listen to a song written by an AI than like my daughter, who's 20. She doesn't mind as much. She minds more because her dad minds, but I don't know that kids are going to care in the future if a song is AI or if it's, you know, written by a human, written, performed, and recorded by a human, or some mix of the two. You know, the biggest hits on Spotify, you know, two or three hits already now have been completely AI generated songs. Yeah. And it doesn't seem like a lot of people care. I can tell you that most of my friends care a lot. They're like, hell no, I don't want to listen to a song written by a machine. Like, what does a machine know about losing a daughter or having a broken heart or going through a tragedy? What does an AI know about hunting or sitting at a river or whatever? You know, it doesn't know anything about life. Like, I don't want to listen to a song by a stupid algorithm. That's dumb. I want to listen to a song written by a person. So I don't know, but I do see things coming back, like photo booths in New York City are massive. Like, what, a photo booth? Like, you get in there, you have a 40 megapixel phone in your pocket that can take incredible pictures the size of a billboard in terms of resolution, and you can take them of anything you want, of bruises, of bad parking jobs, of bad hair days, of food, whatever. Why are you going to stand in line for 2 hours with your friend to get into a photo booth to pay $8 for four little black and white pictures, analog pictures of you guys? Like, why would you do that? Right? Why would that make a comeback? Well, it's because it's the experience.
Right.
It's because it's rare. Like, whatever we do in those four pictures, that's forever, man. Because you can hold it in your hand. So the pictures that you take on your phone in some ways are cheap, right? They're disposable. But this picture that we waited in line for, and we took the picture in the photo booth, like, and we got these four pictures, man. Can I get a copy of those four pictures? You know, that's precious. Vinyl's precious. You know, the fact that people are leaning more into, like, needlecraft. I mean, needlecraft is making a comeback. Can you believe it? Knitting. Like,
my wife just bought a kit.
Really?
Like, yes, like two nights ago.
Surprise me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's coming back. People are like, hey, man, I want it. I want to do something with my hands again. I want to get back to, you know, the craft of making something.
Like, I wonder, because Spotify has two or three songs, or maybe even if they have five songs, top five or something, that are AI generated, but the library is still so human, right? That there's a tolerance level, well, two or three, but like of the, you know, 500 songs they're listening to in a month, that's only two or three. When it becomes dominant AI,
yeah,
and the ratio is not 99 to 2, will we then feel the effects of sedation? Almost like at the dentist, where you get numbing, but you don't feel the numbing yet. And so they give it a minute before they do the root canal or whatever you're overpaying for them to do.
I don't know if you guys saw this story. I think it was like a month ago I saw it, maybe less, that a guy created, I don't know, 8 or 10 AI albums, then created bots on the backside to constantly stream those albums. So he was making like $20,000 a month from Spotify, and nobody was really, anything was human. And he eventually got arrested for it. I don't know what he got arrested for, because he just created algorithms to post into algorithms. But I think it was like maybe money fraud of some sort. But like, that's the far end of it. But like, then I've got young adults, and the young adults who love vinyl records, and they're buying like old school cameras, like film cameras.
Yeah.
So there, it feels like there's this, like, I don't know, spectrum of it, and we're not really sure where we land, and we kind of swing from side to side. Because, I mean, again, like Mike is saying, I think the artist's name is Zayna Monet. She has been like the top streamed Spotify artist for probably 2 or 3 months now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's more and more backlash against AI. Like, I mean, I think both things are going to happen. Brian and Jeff, I think you're both right. Like, I think we are going to get more and more numbed and insensitive to it. I mean, they say that 70% of social media feeds, this is a round general number, don't quote me on it, but they say that 70% is AI generated now. And I know that a lot of the news feeds are 50 to 70% AI generated now. So we're already desensitized, because, like, you know, when you scroll through your newsfeed, like, you don't realize that, like, a lot of those articles weren't even written by a person, right? They might have a person's name on them, but they weren't necessarily written by that person. They were just curated by that person. Mm-hmm. And same thing on Spotify. You know, Spotify they introduced millions of AI generated songs onto people's playlists in 2025 without them realizing that they were doing that. And a lot of people got mad. They were like, dude, I trusted you to curate my playlist. I didn't give you permission to give me songs written by robots.
Interesting.
Right. And so a lot of people were up in arms about it. There was nothing to sue over, because it was just like, well, it's a curated playlist. It's the algorithm already decides what it thinks you like. But I know in video gaming, Video gamers hate AI. They are a vehemently anti-AI. If they play a video game that they paid 70 or 80 or 90 bucks for, I don't know what these video games even cost now. Some of these immersive world games, they're really expensive, and they take really sophisticated machines to even run the game, right? These first-person shooter games and some of these immersive world games. And they want everything to be 100% human. If you render this, it better be a freaking human rendering it, like, in person. I don't want it AI-generated. So, like, even these obscure battle scenes, they're like, wow, the horse's legs are funky. Like, I think AI generated that battle scene. And they will go up in arms about it, and they'll boycott en masse games that they think are AI-generated or have some AI. And video game companies, big ones, are saying to their fan base, we're really sorry we did this, if they did it, if they get caught, which is kind of, I think that's kind of cool. I love that about video gamers. Incidentally, video games are the biggest, they are the biggest money-making media format of all of the formats. Did you know that video games make 3 to 5 times more than any blockbuster film?
Wow.
Grand Theft Auto 5, when it dropped, it outsold Titanic, which is one of the greatest, like, grossing movies of all time, by like 8 times. It made 8 times more money than Titanic. People
That's
don't realize that.
Why?
Those video gamers are sitting there like, you know, but like most people are like, oh, it won the Academy Award and it earned this many hundreds of millions of dollars at the box office, $1 billion at the box office. And like the guys making video games are like, yeah, Grand Theft Auto 5 made like 8 times that much, but nobody talks about it.
Wow. So, that's crazy.
Anyway, I think video games like introduced us to this, though. Like when I was a kid playing Madden, you could play the CPU, like, but you would drive across town to play with your friend, because if I could choose, I want to play against another person, because there was no online platform back then when we were playing. But you didn't want to play against the bot. That was like the lowest fruit. If I didn't have anything else, I guess I'll play against a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are still like that in video games. My son, if he plays Fortnite, he don't want to play against the bots.
Right.
Yeah.
He wants the lobby to be real people.
Exactly. They want to trash talk and be like, oh, I got you. And know that there's real competition happening.
Mike,
I play chess online, and I don't like playing a bot. I want to play another person, you know, so yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt. No. How much, though, as I think about this, in this AI, humanity, creative space, and one of the things I've seen recently is that especially among Gen Z and younger millennials, there's a big push to go back to live events. I think post-COVID, everybody was in their house, and they're like, oh, this is great. We're home for 2 weeks, and we were home for a long time. But there seems to be this return to wanting to experience things in person and together. How much will that impact this drive to keep creating from humanity?
Live events are more popular now than they've ever been in the history of like live events. I mean, in 2025 alone, I mean, you had Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, you had Coldplay, you had tons of hip hop artists were out. And you had these massive tours that were earning more money than any tours had ever earned previously. I think 2025 was the biggest live music earning year in history. So people are wanting to go out and see live shows again. And AI is never going to be able to touch performance art, right? Performing arts, things that you go, when you want to go hear YouTube, like you're never going to go hear a robot sing into a microphone on a stage. I don't think. I mean, I can't, I'm a futurist and I can't even see that being like something that happens. Maybe it will for novelty, but
yeah,
you're going to follow real human artists. You're going to see, you know, Bruce Springsteen in concert. You're going to see, you know, Taylor Swift or whoever. And so I love that. I think there's a massive comeback, and people are going back to the movies more now than ever before. I mean, COVID really hurt the film in the theater industry. It didn't hurt the film industry in the sense that they stopped making films, but it really hurt the film release model in theaters.
Right.
You know, that whole idea of like, you get it at the theater first and you have to wait for it on streaming and other places. But that's starting to turn around now. It's great. I think COVID, some ways, I think it helped us realize how much we need each other.
Right. Yeah.
I'd be curious to hear from both of you. We've talked about the AI and the effects of creativity, but also like as people that have faith and theology and those things, and pastors that are typing in message prompts and those things. Is that in any of your discussions like that you're having? Does that even your creative friend group that you have, the stone sculptor, I definitely want to meet. But
oh, he's cool.
Are those kind of topics? Are you digging into that?
Yeah, well, you know, I was a pastor in two of the largest evangelical churches in Richmond, Virginia for almost 20 years. And so I know a lot about sermon prep. I've been in the green room hundreds of times, so getting mic'd up and all that stuff. So I know the pressure of speaking, and I know that, you know, that a lot of pastors are using AI to help them with sermon prep. But yeah, the whole notion of AI in churches in general, I mean, I think the church faces a similar problem and opportunity as everybody else. Does anybody want their pastor to not spend 20 hours on the sermon? No. I mean, I think I used to say, if you spend less than 20 hours in your sermon, I don't want to hear it. Hmm. So it's like, do I want to hear a ChatGPT sermon? Like, I don't know. Could I tell the difference? I'm not sure. How bad is my pastor at speaking? Maybe the chat sermon would be better than what he normally does. You know,
I've been some places chat could have helped.
I might have been guilty of that a couple times.
As a young preacher, I was. As a young preacher, for sure.
With a chat sermon, you know, it's going to have a flow and have a point. You know, sometimes preachers just get up there and they just kind of go ad hoc for
the disasters can be entertaining, though, I will say.
Those are the most painful.
Yeah. But, you know, but theologically speaking, it's huge. If you are a Christian, a Muslim, or you're Jewish, then you represent faith traditions of more than half of the world's population. Okay. Those three faith traditions share something in common. They have the first five books of the Bible in common, the Pentateuch. All three of those religions would say, you know, the first five books of the Bible are sacred in their scriptures. And this describes one God that's creative. The God does what? Creates the universe by snapping his fingers? By waving a wand? No. He does it by speaking. He uses words to create. So the universe is a speech event. The creation of the universe is a speech event. The Big Bang, as they say, was a speech event. God spoke the universe into existence. He spoke all the living things, all the things he said. So words have this creative power. And that's, LLMs are based on words. LLMs are all based on words, right? So so go on further. Like when God creates human beings, what's the first job that he gives human beings? He says, I want you to name all the living things. What? Name them. Why? Because when you name them, you give them a taxonomy, a hierarchy. You give them a place in this system. Putting names on things is really important because it's how you understand things. You understand things by putting names on them. Why do we do psychology? Well, because the only way to fix a human brain is either to cut it up with a brain surgery or to stick a bunch of drugs in your system that will affect the chemistry, or psychology. You have to get someone to talk with words about what's wrong and broken in your brain.
So
language is incredibly powerful in the human experience. And if you're a person of faith, you have to realize that language is fundamental to human existence. So when these large language models started proliferating and using words in ways that human beings are using them, that's a theological issue.
Yeah.
Because now you've got a machine that's operating with creative power. The same creative power that God gave us. The same creative power that God himself has in creating by using words, right? I'm not saying to the level, but I'm saying that the idea of creating new realities by describing them is a very human thing. And now we have non-human things able to do that. Right. What does that mean theologically? That's a big, fat question that you bring up.
Wow. I mean, wow, Brian, you really took us deep, because now I'm going, should I use ChatGPT at all?
Yeah, I love this conversation.
Maybe I'll ask ChatGPT to let me know if I should use it.
Yeah, I just...
That was a joke, but...
Yeah, I don't think that we're answering the questions. I think we're asking better questions of ourselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, okay, I mean, I know so many, even like, you know, people in my community, in my like small community, that are using these engines to discover things that they kind of know way in the back of their brain. Mm-hmm. Where is this found? Who said this about this thing? And so they're using this, you know, almost like as an exploratory like device.
Yeah.
But it also, it seems to have this personality that is trying to shape.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
you feel about yourself. That's a great question, right? Like, oh, wonderful. Like an exclamation point. So it's like, it's not just information. It's information curated for an experience even.
Yeah.
Well, and it's been caught making things up. Like ChatGPT is like making up facts as well. Like we thought it was just pulling things, but more and more we pull the thread, it's actually taking a blend of facts to create new facts. Which becomes dangerous. I think there was just recently a court case this week where an attorney had used ChatGPT to find precedents, and like she presented all this precedents, and the judge goes, "I'm sorry, those are not real cases." Like he threw the whole thing out. He's like, "Your precedents is not real." He asked, "Where did you get this?" She's, "Well, I asked ChatGPT." And it made up court cases.
Yeah, it's insane. Like it not only, you know, they call that hallucination. When the AI says something that's wrong, erroneous, or off, and it will say it with absolute confidence. When I was writing this book, there were almost 500 end notes in this book before I, you know, got them down to what they are now. And so I did a ton of research on the book, but a lot of it was like, there were books that I didn't have access to. So I used ChatGPT to help me get all of the citations right. Well, what I realized about halfway through the process was, oh my gosh, like 6 or 8 of these citations out of 50 are completely wrong. Because when I would go back and check them with Perplexity, it was like, no, that book doesn't exist. I'm like, it has an author's name, the title of a book, a city of publication, a publishing house's name, a date, a page number. And it just presented that to me as if it was like real. And it's completely 100% phony. And I thought, wow, I can't trust this. Like I have to verify everything it gives me before I move forward. That's the scary part, is then you've got people getting really bad advice and committing suicide or getting into relationship trouble because they're asking a chatbot and they're not thinking and they're not using their own brain. So
we're relationships with chatbot. Like that's a real trend.
Or fall in love with their instance of Claude.
Yeah. Well, there was this like little window of time where I felt like it became really easy to fact check things quickly.
Yeah.
You could sit in a classroom, you could sit in a church or at an event. Somebody could make a statement. This happened in this year in this location. You could fact check it. Well, now I feel like we can still fact check it, but we have so much more suspicion even of our fact check.
I know.
Where before, somebody would walk up to you after you got done preaching or after you did your speech and they say, "Look, you're wrong. This says you're wrong."
Right.
And you just had to own that. Now I feel like you can say, "Sorry, that's wrong. I'm right."
That's wrong. That's right. That's hallucinating.
Right.
It's not a hallucination.
And it becomes difficult now. That window where you could fact check really easily, I feel like it's closed.
And I'm not sure we're better off, you know, like, do we need to know everything? Do we need to be able to verify everything? Like when I was a kid, I would ask my mom some things like, "Hey, what about this or this? You know, like, well, tell me about this." And she'd just be like, "I don't know." And she's like, why don't you check the encyclopedia? We had an encyclopedia set. There was no internet.
Yeah. Right.
Same. If you didn't know something, you looked it up in the encyclopedia. If it wasn't there, then she's just like, well, you'll have to ask God someday. That's literally just what she said. Like, we just won't know the answer to that until we get to heaven someday.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was just like, yeah, well, putting it on the list. That are the things I'm going to ask God, because I just can't know that. It's unknowable to me. Somebody knows it, but I can't get access to that information. Well, the internet changed all that. And then Google, you could just, you didn't have to not know anything ever again. You could always figure out like what you wanted to know. How tall is Dustin Hoffman? You know, like you can just look it up and it's like, oh, he's 5'7". You know?
Yeah. I think I irritate myself. Like I do. I find myself watching a movie, watching a show or something, and an actor or actress comes up and I go, what else were they in? Right. Yeah. And instead of taking the moment to think it through, I'm like, I'll just Google it or IMDb it. Like, yeah. I'll just look it up. Right. And I think, I don't know if it's making us dumber, but it is creating, I think, a struggle where we're not really good problem solvers. I think we're losing capacity to solve problems without assistance of some sort.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right about that. That's a massive problem for education right now and for all of us. Think about when you guys remember when there was no cell phones, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. You probably, when you were kids, probably had like 30 numbers memorized in your brain. I can still remember my number from when I was 5 years old, 676-2770. I lived in Abilene, Texas. And I remember my phone number from when I was 5 years old, 6 years old. I was in kindergarten. Now I don't even know my son's cell phone number without looking at it.
Yeah.
You know, it's so weird, but it's because I don't have to think about it anymore. I just press his name in my phone. But yeah, we've lost the ability. Now I'm like, I have a hard time remembering this 7-digit code to do a double opt-in login or something like that. And I'm like, what happened to my capacity to retain, you know, series of numbers in my brain? I used to have it, but I clearly do not have that anymore. And it's like a muscle that if you don't work it, it atrophies. And I think that's happening with critical thinking big time. And I think AI is going to make it worse.
Mm. So do you think we'll see a return of the arts? And I see the arts, physical arts, painting, drawing, writing, music to help us. Because there's so much more to than just creating. There's so much more that does for the brain that we'll see a return of that to help us become, I don't have a better way to say it, but more human again. Like, I think we've lost a piece of humanity by not being creative. Do you think we'll see some push for people to be creative again just to redeem humanity?
I hope so, Jeff. I really hope so. I'm optimistic because, you know, you mentioned something that I think is more insightful than we gave time to. And that's the fact that the pendulums of society and of life and of human life swing back and forth, right? And so, you know, it swings one way when a new idea comes, and then it kind of course corrects. So this notion that for the last 30 years, kids don't go outside enough.
Yeah.
People are starting like to be like, no, that's not okay. Like the fact that they're the extensions of a machine and that their faces are stuck in screens for like 15 hours of their day, that's not healthy.
Yeah.
And we need to course correct for that. So like, you know, when my kids were growing up, I was like, you have to go outside and touch the ground. You have to touch the earth. You have to like touch a stick, touch some dirt, like connect with the real earth again. Like don't just sit in this isolated room with your headphones on, staring at a screen, doing something that's really just, it doesn't even really exist, you know? And so I'm hoping that we course correct. I'm hoping that humans will say some of the stuff that AI is some of the ways that it's affecting our life are gross and we don't want to do that. So that I think I'm optimistic that the pendulum will correct and swing back the other way a little bit.
I think your voice in the arts, and then there's other voices like Dr. Jonathan Haidt, who wrote the book Anxious Generation, and a couple other people even in higher ed who are going, we've got to reduce technology, if not remove it altogether. So Tennessee just went bell to bell, no cell, and through all schools, they can have their cell phone out at school, which was a huge shift.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, they passed in July. And again, the panic of parents was like, but what if I need to call Johnny? Well, you know where Johnny's at. Johnny's in class. Like, but those conversations, and then this, then I think what you're bringing up is so important in the arts of going, like, we have to go back to being creators and producers of real things, like, and real thought, and having capacity to have human interaction. Like, again, I think the funniest thing I heard a couple of years ago was, like, we have a whole generation that can put somebody on blast on social media, but can't ask for ranch dressing. Like, they just
that's
have
real.
this struggle, right? And so my hope is that, like, human is the new vinyl, that there is this resurgence of just humanity and creativity and community that got lost somewhere in our love affair of technology. And I love technology. This makes this possible, right?
Yeah.
But I don't want it to come at the expense of community and capacity to create.
Yeah. I think there is a innate desire in humans for awe and wonder.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I remember I got a chance to go to Victoria Falls, and it was unbelievable. I didn't do the helicopter thing, but just go out to the falls and did a little hike and stuff like that. And
wow.
I remember coming back, and I didn't take a lot of pictures and videos even of it, because I know I can just go on Google and show, okay, so when I come home, I'm trying to, like, show my kids a few of the little pictures because they weren't with me on that trip. And I remember looking at the drone footage, this massive drone footage, and I told them, it's better when you get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's not. It doesn't matter that drone has a perspective I didn't.
Yeah.
The water in your face. There's something about the rainbow looks different with your own eye that can't be captured. And it brings an awe and a wonder. And I told him, you can see the picture. And my wife one time said, I don't want to see the picture because I don't want it to ruin it for me. I was like, look at all the photos. You can look at all of them.
Mm-hmm. It won't ruin
it. It's bigger and more majestic in real life. And so you can look at all the photos, but I'm telling you, being there is still better. And I think we have this desire for wonder.
Yeah.
That will eventually, like, rise up in generations to say, the video game doesn't give me wonder anymore.
Yeah.
The generative thing is not really inspiring awe. But I actually saw this thing 20 miles down the road. You have to go to this place with me. And it's... I think we'll have more options to communicate quicker because of all of the technology. So now everybody can know 20 minutes from here, we geotagged this place. It's unbelievable at 7 o'clock, you know, at night. This is a place to watch the sunrise or sunset or whatever it is. But
yeah,
we want awe and wonder.
That's absolutely right. I mean, has any photograph of a sunset ever been as good as the actual sunset?
No.
Right. Never. It's never, never as good. You're absolutely right about that. And I hope that all these things become true. I hope that awe and wonder rise up in humans again. But it's going to take adults making decisions that are hard, that their kids push back on too. You know, like, parents are going to have to say, hey, 10 hours of Minecraft today is too much.
Yeah.
And that's tough because the kid's like, but so it's tough. And I get it.
I was having an argument with our oldest daughter, who by is at Belmont as well. We can talk Belmont when we get off the air.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And I told her, like, punishment for me as a kid was my mom would just send me outside. Like, if I annoyed her enough, she goes, just go outside. Yeah. Like, go into the yard. Hilarious. Go ride your bike. Like, that was my punishment. I thought it was terrible until I got outside, and I was like, this is awesome. I'm going to go ride my bike in the neighborhood.
Maybe we
need to punish our kids a little bit like that. Just push them out. And so I'm with you, Mike. I hope that humanity gets restored into the creative things, and also in just the capacity to think creatively.
Yeah.
It seems
about that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go, please.
You think about that, you know, go outside. Most kids, if you sent them out to the backyard, they would just kind of stand there and just be like, "What? What do I do? What do I do?" You know, it's like, well, yeah, we'll just be out there long enough, though, and mm-hmm. any kid is going to be like, well, you know, we would just find stuff to do. We'd start looking around at the trees and be like, can I climb this? You know, what's on the side of that fence? And then we'd start, you know, what do we have here? What can we build? What can we make? What, how can we play with this? You know, how can we figure something out? Do we want to dig a hole? Let's dig a hole. You know, we just just figure out stuff to do, you know? Yeah. And so I don't think kids know how to play outside anymore that much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, no, no. You're good. That I agree. I don't think. I think that the art of adventure was a little bit digitized.
Yeah.
And we lost creating it on our own outside, building the fort. Like, and then we recreated all these things in a digital landscape. Minecraft mm-hmm. is what we used to do in the backyard with sticks and ropes and duct tape and whatever nails we could find in the shed. We created this wildly unsafe environment. Like, we had tetanus shots.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we needed them.
Yes.
That's right.
And
that's
right. So we lost a
Who
little
even
bit
needs
of that
a
art.
Tetanus shot anymore, right?
Right.
That should be the mark of childhood. Yeah. Did you need a tetanus shot?
Yeah. Did you need a tetanus shot?
That's how you know it was a good time.
Yeah, you stepped on a rusty nail for sure. Yeah.
We want this AI thing, though. We want it to be as human as possible, which is we mm-hmm. want it to be like us, which is ironic.
Yeah.
The fact that we're already human. Mm-hmm. Like, you can have the human experience without it. You're what it is trying to be.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's a good statement.
It is really weird. It's a weird thing. I remember going, my son and I used to run on this trail in Richmond called the Buttermilk Trail. It is beautiful. It's one of the greatest runs. Like, I dream of going on this run now, but it's a trail run. And it's through the woods, but it also goes over this river, and it's like you can see the whole city. And I remember when he was so into Minecraft, I'd be like, hey, Ethan, look at the resolution on these trees, man. It's incredible. It's almost as good as 4K. What?
4K.
What's the 4K? It's almost as good as 4K. And he was like, shut up, Dad. I'm like, that tree looks so real. I'm like, because it is real.
Yeah.
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 Well, Mike, we have loved our conversation with you about AI. We got a couple final questions we want to ask every guest. I'll let Brian go first on his.
Yeah.
So the podcast being a couple of nobodies, we recognize like a lot of people are jumping in and listening because they're interested in what you have to say. And sure. But I also know that usually you don't start out doing something great because you think you're important. You think you have an important work to do. And when you started out writing a book and that kind of stuff, sometimes we feel like we're a nobody in this environment. Why would anybody listen to me? As you talk to artists and creatives and people who are out there who might even feel like a nobody, they haven't gone viral, they're not famous or anything. What would you say to inspire people to actually do the thing, to create, to write, to what? And people who feel like they live in obscurity, what would you say that would just wire them up to go for it?
Well, I don't know that I have the ability to wire anyone up to do anything, but I do feel like a nobody a lot of times.
Really?
And I've been in places where I was well known, where I couldn't walk into a Starbucks in a city with a million people without knowing somebody. Now I live in Cleveland and I walk into Starbucks all the time and nobody knows me. I walk through Walmart or Food City all the time. And I'm like, nobody knows who I am. And it's great. You know, it's like, I'm a nobody too. So, what I've done with Verified Human was identify something that I really care about that matters to me. And then I just started working at it a little bit and started saying, what can I do? What are the levers that I can pull? Now we have, and Verified Human has, we've got hundreds of creatives in 25 countries on 6 continents. And so that's cool in some senses, but nobody knows about Verified Human that much. I mean, not like you guys probably didn't know about it before you came across my stuff. So it's not like a well-known thing, But it still matters to all those people in it, and it matters to me. It's a relatively small movement. I'm in C2PA, which is a massive movement for content provenance. The BBC's in it. Adobe's in it. Mm. Warner Brothers is in it. And I'm in these rooms with these people. They don't have a clue who I am or what I do. I'm just a face on the screen, man. So I think it's the most important thing for everybody to know is that we're all nobodies. It really, and that's okay. That's great. Yeah. Because you're not a nobody to God, and you're not a nobody to the people that you love and who love you.
I love that.
And this quote is literally, I'm going to pull it so you believe me, on my computer screen. It says, if I'm known by God and those I love, that's all the known I need.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And so, yeah, man, just do what God has called you to do. Do what is in your heart to do. Work hard. Be honest. Try to enjoy the day. Try and chill out and not take yourself too seriously. That's what I would tell everybody. It's what I tell my kids all the time. Hey, my daughter might be a famous recording artist someday. My son might be a famous entrepreneur someday. But even if they're not, they're still my son and daughter, and that's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Last question. I love that answer. We all have nobodies in our life, people who have inspired us, pushed us, who nobody knows or very few people know. Who's maybe a nobody in your life that you would love the world to know about?
Well, that's a great question. I'd love everyone to know about my stepdad, who was a lot more like my real dad. Mm. He just passed away in December of 2025, so just a couple months ago. But he was a great human being. He was a West Point grad, so he was really smart. He was a NASA engineer for a while. Wow. He worked on the original space shuttle. Like the first shuttle.
Oh,
and,
wow.
But nobody knows his name. His name is David DePue. And he was a really kind man. And he taught me to love the Lord. He taught me to have a high view of scripture. He taught me that churches come and go, but relationships remain. A lot of things. He was a missionary. He was a badass. He was kind. He was a kind killer. He was like trained to be an airborne ranger, in ranger school and jumping out of airplanes and all that stuff, and to be this combat soldier and this sniper and all this stuff. But he was a gentle soul that just wanted to spread God's love to other people. So he's the perfect nobody that is somebody to me.
Awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, man, that's great. I wish I could have met him.
Yeah, that's
for
me
sure.
Too. Me too.
He was cool, man.
Yeah,
he was really
that's
cool.
That's awesome.
Well, Micah, we are so thankful for you coming on, sharing with us and our listeners. And listen, you're just one of us. You're just a couple of nobodies with Micah.
Yeah. Hey, I am grateful to be in your club.